You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We are rooted in community support and engagement. Thank you for helping us stay on air.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Last show, we were looking at the subchapter, Trends. There are many sectors of the sharing economy that I have not covered in detail because they have remained relatively small to date. The community nature of these has also been exaggerated. The leading player in the pet services world, for example, Dog Vacay, is mentioned routinely in the sharing economy articles and has now signed up to 20,000 North American hosts. The site may look to build a community feel, but researcher Guyana Eckhart, building on her experience researching Zipcar, see Chapter 4, suggests that its success is more likely to rely on another mechanism for establishing trust, saying that, quote, in the sharing economy, consumers look towards those companies to provide the type of Big Brother surveillance that is needed to overcome trust issues. And this effect is amplified when a living creature is involved. Social dining is a sector they may yet break out. Feastly and Viz Eat and Eat With and other more than 20 or so other startups in this space invite people to dine in homes, connect with hosts, share stories, and enjoy homemade cuisine, portraying their exchanges as part of the informal private sphere. And up to a point, that's appropriate. There's always been a place for food at a commons-based sharing experience. And as a way to meet new people, there's a long history of dining clubs organized within social circles. As a low-intensity, largely uncommercial activity, perhaps like the 5 million or so Americans that take part in book clubs, it does not need regulation, apparently. Social dining is a sector that may well break out in the future. Feastly and Viz Eat and Eat With and the other 20 or so startups in the space invite people to dine in their homes, connect with hosts, share stories, and enjoy homemade cuisine, portraying their exchanges as part of informal private spheres. And up to a point, that's appropriate. There's always been a place for food and common-based sharing experiences as a way to meet new people. There's a long history of dining clubs organized within social circles. As a low-intensity, largely uncommercial activity, perhaps like the 5 million or so Americans that take part in book clubs, it does not need regulation. Where it does go wrong is one of these companies succeeds in taking it global. Guided by venture capitalists with previous experience, building a big business in the social dining sector by taking a fee for each meal and encouraging hosts to see it as money-making opportunities. The history of successful sharing economy companies tells us how it is likely to go. A breakout company in the sector is likely to have a business model that positions the meals as private exchanges, claiming that the meals arranged through their platform have no need for health and safety inspectors and should not have to charge sales tax. At the same time, it will encourage vendors to build businesses on the platform and look to take a slice of each business. It may even adopt a blockbuster strategy and look for big partners to team up with. And to the extent that they become successful, they will have to undermine the premise of their venture. Intimacy scaled up is no longer intimacy. Uber has continued its meteoric rise throughout the year 2015, and together with Airbnb, its growth has been taken as a demonstration of the superiority of this emerging form of company, in which employees are replaced by contractors and managers are replaced by reputation systems. Tim O'Reilly writes that this demonstrates, quote, the way that networks trump traditional forms of corporate organization, unquote. And he generally welcomes the inevitable rise of these technology-driven firms. But the allure of the seamless app experience covers a multitude of less savory but no less important behind-the-scenes factors in driving the success of these businesses. Technology does bring new efficiencies, but also serves as an opportunity to build new business models that externalize costs by restructuring regulations that balance the interests of companies and the communities in which they live, or that balance the interests of companies and service providers. Airbnb's relentless promotion of tourism over every other aspect of a city's well-being shows that its commitment to cities and to communities stops as soon as its bank account is challenged. While the company is prepared to make some compromises with local governments, such as collecting hospitality taxes, one thing it steadfastly refuses to do is to share its list of hosts with local governments. In this way, Airbnb hobbles any attempt to limit the density of Airbnb rentals in particular districts, or to avoid the gentrification that accompanies a sudden influx of tourists. And it leads the company into repeated conflicts with city governments in places such as Barcelona and Amsterdam, where tourism is a mixed blessing. It also hobbles realistic investigations of the company's impact on affordable housing, community zoning rules, and so on. Airbnb makes its money by imposing a whole series of costs on the communities in which it operates. Uber's ability to provide value to its customers not only comes from its technology, but also, as we saw in Chapter 4, from its ability to externalize costs. Beyond this, the company keeps costs down by running at a loss in order to foster growth. It's a common thread throughout the sharing economy. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act says that, quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider, unquote. This law means that bloggers are not legally responsible for what commentators write on their site, that YouTube is not legally responsible for videos that users upload, Facebook is not responsible for what users post, and so on. But the law has repeatedly been interpreted broadly, extending protection to all kinds of online platforms. And sharing economy companies have argued that the law means that they are not responsible for the actions of their service providers, or for what goes on between service providers and customers. Presenting themselves as marketplaces, as technology companies, and not as service providers allows the claim that Section 230 applies to them. Taxi companies may be responsible for taxi rides, but if you're a ride-sharing provider, you don't want that expense. Hotels and B&Bs may be responsible for what happens to their guests, but if you're Airbnb, you don't want that kind of liability. It may seem far-fetched that a company like Uber, which is now experimenting with taking roughly 30% of the fare for each ride, which includes a $1 safety fee in the price, has no responsibility when things go wrong on that ride. And when Uber was designated as transportation network company in California, the question was left, unfortunately, open. But for sharing economy companies, Section 230 is a good start until courts show otherwise. Legislation such as New York State Senators Liz Krueger are frustrated by this law. Speaking about Airbnb, she said, quote, "We have not been able to find a way as a state government to say, Airbnb, we know you're breaking laws and we're going to stop you." So frankly, these companies look at me and go, "You're a fly on the wall. We don't care. We can't do any. You can't do anything to us." Yes, you can go after the people who illegally rent out the apartments. You can go after the people who illegally rent as tourists. But us, the ones who, as their business model, are actively encouraging and supporting illegal activity, there's nothing that you can do to us. Unquote. Successful sharing economy companies avoid the expense of ensuring safety. They do not state publicly their commitment to safety and make some gestures in that direction. Airbnb chose to give free smoke alarms to hosts. Uber claims to have a safety inspection on its vehicles, but they also do what they can to avoid municipal rules such as fire inspections for bed and breakfasts. And they make sure that they are not on the hook for things when things go wrong. Successful sharing economy companies also avoid the expense of providing universal access provisions. In Chapter 4, we saw Uber and Lyft claim that access for the disabled is not their problem. Suggestions that Airbnb's platform inadvertently enables the propagation of racial profiling have met with the same response. Successful sharing economy companies avoid the expense of wages by keeping their service providers off the payroll and classifying themselves instead as independent contractors, often called 1099 workers, after the U.S. tax form that they have to fill in. As part of this move, the companies avoid paying benefits, avoid paying for equipment, and avoid paying for idle time and travel time, and avoid insuring against injury, and avoid any pension obligations. More than a decade ago, Amazon successfully avoided being responsible for sales tax in most states for many years, giving it a natural price advantage over brick-and-mortar stores. And the major internet companies such as Google and Apple now have become experts at routing the business through low-tax subsidiaries in Ireland and Luxembourg to minimize their tax burdens. Successful sharing economy companies have learned from these efforts. Taxi passengers in Toronto pay sales tax to the province of Ontario. The taxi driver pays tax on their earnings. And the taxi company, if there is one, also pays taxes. Uber passengers pay their fee to Uber BV, an Uber subsidiary in the Netherlands, so that Uber pays no taxes. Uber also leaves the question of taxes on the driver's income to the drivers, knowing full well that many cash-strapped drivers will avoid paying taxes if possible. Airbnb makes claims about its willingness to pay tourist taxes on behalf of the hosts when needed, and to encourage its hosts to register with the city if required. But example after example, for example, see Chapter 3, shows that they have done so in a self-interested way that continues to leave cities highly frustrated. Successful sharing economy companies have learned how to minimize insurance costs. Uber and Lyft started by arguing that no commercial insurance was necessary for private rides, and ever since have made efforts to minimize the coverage they provide in face of demands from cities, pushing insurance requirements onto drivers without demanding verification, knowing that many will be tempted to avoid the expense of full insurance. In many locations, for example, gaps persist for when drivers are using the app but are not driving customers. Successful sharing economy companies have not been able to shirk all these responsibilities, but they have taken an approach inspired by Peter Thiel, an investor in several of the leading players. Foreseeing problems with financial regulations, Thiel's companies, PayPal, pioneered an aggressive approach to the problem, raised a boatload of money, expand quickly, and present lawmakers with a fait accompli. Here is the future. Now deal with it. Sharing economy companies' price advantage, the reason for so much investor interest in the sector, and the reason for the corresponding massive market validations of these leading players, is not just a product of the efficiencies of their technology. It also a product of the ability to circumvent or change regulations. It's why Uber and Airbnb have invested heavily in the high-profile and well-connected lobbyists at the national level and make intensive lobbying efforts in key cities. Here is Bloomberg's Karen Weiss on Uber's impressive lobbying efforts in Portland, Oregon. Over the past year, Uber built one of the largest and most successful lobbying forces in the country, with a presence in almost every state house. It has 250 lobbyists and 29 lobbying firms registered in capitals around the nation, at least a third more than Walmart stores. That doesn't count municipal lobbyists. In Portland, the 28th largest city in the U.S., 10 people will ultimately register to lobby on Uber's behalf. They'd become a constant force in City Hall. City officials say they've never seen anything on this scale. Tim O'Reilly writes that, quote, "This discussion around companies like Uber and Airbnb is too narrow. The issue isn't just employment, but a large economic shift led by software and connectedness. But to see the issue as one of software and connectedness is far too narrow. It is also about power, money, and influence."
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. The language of peer-to-peer trust, so prominent in so many stories, is now falling to one side. Reputation systems are a front for companies being able to deactivate users and to impose their own discipline. Airbnb ejects hosts from its platform when it is politically expedient, as recently happened in Los Angeles. And Uber fires drivers at executives' whim. The sharing economy has become an opportunity to take decision-making powers out of the reach of elected bodies and place them in now extravagantly glass-walled but still opaque San Francisco boardrooms. Expensive lobbyists are arguing to officials in Washington that the new companies can regulate the behavior of their service providers better than governments, that algorithms are better guarantees than old-fashioned rules, and that free markets will ensure that the algorithmically enhanced companies will exert their influence in responsible and socially beneficial ways. The effectiveness of reputation systems and algorithmic rating systems is providing a solid basis for trust and is exaggerated in the sharing economy world. Sites that rely on algorithmic ratings have run into problems of fairness and of proper process. For example, marketplace lending company lending clubs. By becoming a new way to qualify potential borrowers, the marketplace lending companies are entering into the era of credit scoring. Data scientist Kathy O'Neill argues that one reason lending club and others can bring such value to big financial institutions is that they provide a way to bypass credit scoring regulations, such as the Federal Credit Commission's Equal Credit Opportunities Act, known as ECODA, E-C-O-A, that prohibits credit discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, and other factors, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, known as FCRA. In their early days, lending club and other marketplace lending companies argued that they do not provide loans, just as Uber does not provide rides. Handy does not provide cleaning services, and Airbnb does not provide accommodation. As a result, their business model fell into a regulatory gap. Since then, and particularly since a significant rate of defaults in 2008, the Securities and Exchange Commission has stepped in to require a little more accountability from these firms. But important parts of its model remained outside the scope of any practical regulation. Just as Airbnb has a search algorithm that implicitly ranks hosts, and just as Uber uses its detailed data on everyone on its platform to govern the behavior of its drivers, so Lending Club uses a proprietary mathematical model to score potential borrowers, and it rejects about 90% of applicants. The input includes data purchased from data brokers such as Axiom or Experian, early stage models in the peer-to-peer lending world, looked at social media profiles and other factors such as web browsing habits, employment histories, anything that they can get their hands on. But this appetite for data can easily and perhaps inadvertently run into ECODA, ECOA, or FCRA provisions, indicators that align with race and other factors for discrimination can be used. And those who are refused loans have a way of finding out the reason for their denial or appealing a lending club decision. The algorithm becomes a black box into which neither regulators nor those who are assessed and rated by it can look into and see. Pushing back. Faced with the influence and ambition of the sharing economy, an increasing number of groups have found their voices and are pushing back. In Europe, where Airbnb makes the majority of its revenue and where Uber is pushing to grow, there were two significant developments in June 2015 alone. The most dramatic was the taxi drivers' protest in France. Uber's UberPop service, the equivalent of Uber X service in North America was declared illegal in 2014, but Uber instructed its drivers to keep operating while it appealed the ruling. Taxi drivers' frustrated confrontations with riot police pushed the Paris government to clamp down on the service. Uber was following the same pattern in other countries. In August, it stated that it would support drivers fined by police in Costa Rica, an act that has an unpleasant resonance in a part of the world where American companies have taken part in challenging and even overthrowing local governments. Meanwhile, Barcelona elected a new mayor, radical activist Ada Colau, who stood as a leader of the anti-eviction group called Mortgage Victims Platform. One of the issues of her campaign was tourism. The annual number of tourists now outnumbers the number of residents by more than four times. And persistent issues with noise, illegal tourist flats, and rising real estate prices have led weary residents to draw battle lines in recent years against the seeming never-ending tide of camera-toting, beer-swilling visitors. Colau vowed to stop Barcelona, quote, ending up like Venice, unquote, a city where locals have been pushed out almost completely by tourists. In this environment, Airbnb's bland assurances of the opportunity to live like a local, its continued reminders of the money that it brings to the city, and its complete refusal to consider any civic role in shaping the supply of tourist apartments sounds an off-note. In the U.S., too, there's been a resistance to the sharing economy incursions. The independent contractor status of Uber and the on-demand cleaning services have drawn legal challenges. Chapter 5 described how the issue affected cleaning services, HomeJoy, and Handy, but let's take a broader look. In Canada, if cleaners were on the payroll, then a company would have to pay taxes. Employment insurance contributions and Canada Pension Plans contributions, by classifying them as independent contractors, all these onerous costs are completely eliminated. Kevin Hipkins of Molly Maid, an Ontario cleaning service company with about 1,200 employees, claims that if we could wave a magic wand, we could bring down our costs by about 30% and avoid all of this messy tax stuff. Taxation is a moral responsibility. I think we are creating a culture of tax cheats. So we're going to continue looking at this the next show. And then we're going to move on to another book, which I think you'll find very exciting. So please keep listening to my show. I'm happy to have you as a listener.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
This bird note. An American dipper calls across a rushing mountain stream. It's a rotund little bird with a stone-gray body that bobs